Welcome everyone to this fifth lecture in the series on accommodating injustice. My topic today is accommodating attitudes, and of course that's a very ambiguous title. You will remember that in the first lecture I talked about how sometimes through being rather accommodating as hearers, sometimes we we accommodate ourselves to hate speakers or to other speakers, and our accommodation in that sense of being helpful when we shouldn't be, that accommodation actually gives the speech illocutionary force that it otherwise would lack. So accommodation in that sense is, in the colloquial sense, about sometimes being too accommodating. That's not my topic today, though I will be talking about it in the final lecture next week. My chief topic today is about accommodation in the much more specific sense that I've been using it in throughout these previous lectures, where it has to do with the process of adjustment in conversations that makes your speech act count as correct play. The process of adjustment where someone says something, what needs to happen for that something to count as correct play might be a certain presupposition, it might be a certain norm, and provided certain conditions are in place, the magic happens and your speech act gets to count as correct play. That's the process of accommodation that is described by linguists, and of course it is connected to that wider issue, that more colloquial issue of accommodation in the sense of being helpful, because as hearers we help the speakers by doing what's expected, and in doing what's expected through our actions and our attitudes, we give the speaker the power to perform the speech acts that they are meaning to perform. Or maybe they're not meaning to perform them, because I certainly don't want to say intention is always necessary for any speech act. Now, today I want to talk about accommodating attitudes. Attitudes of both hearers and speakers feature as felicity conditions of illocutionary speech acts, determining how they're going to be accommodated. So in lectures 1 to 4, we talked about how the attitudes of hearers, of acceptance, might be felicity conditions for the success of someone's speech act. The attitudes of speakers intending to do something, they might be felicity conditions for certain speech acts. And attitudes therefore feed into the process of accommodation as felicity conditions. They also are present in accommodation as the causal outcome of the process of accommodation. And here I know I'm going to need to remind you of something that I said in the first lecture but didn't say nearly enough about. I want to draw attention to two different sorts of accommodation. This is drawing on the work of philosophers of language like David Lewis and J.L. Austin. Also more recent work in this area, Mary Kate McGowan and Liz Camp. And part of the story is about what Austin called illocution, and part of that's what the speech act is. What you do in pronouncing certain words. You'll recall that Austin was very interested in what we do with our words, how saying, "I hereby name this ship the Queen Elizabeth," is straight away to name the ship. It's not about producing some effects in the downstream moments in time. Straight away, at that time, you name the ship. But there are, of course, effects, and people are going to come to call the ship the Queen Elizabeth, and those effects are what Austin called the perlocutionary act. Linguists and philosophers working in this area nowadays tend to focus on accommodation conceived of in terms of the evolving attitudes of are participants in a conversation. Some of them call it common ground. I think that is great, but if you only focus on that, if you only focus on the way in which beliefs evolve over time to generate knowledge, given what people do with their words, you're going to miss out on the enactment that was done in the first place at the stage that Austin called illocution. So when I say I want to describe two sorts of accommodation, I want to describe accommodation of, I'll just call it score, and accommodation of common ground, and I'm going to say why these are two different things. Accommodation of score, you can think of as an evolving normative structure, not an evolving set of attitudes. It's an evolving normative structure that constrains and enables what speakers and hearers can do. It tracks what's done straightway. You'll remember that I drew attention to the way Austin used the word straightway, that very nice biblical word, straightway. At that very time of the utterance, the score changes. Recall that the ongoing analogy is with a sports game, which needn't be a competitive game. I know there is a lot to be said against the metaphor of games as these competitive, hostile things. But anything that has a game-like structure that involves certain moves being made at certain points, with attitudes changing in response to those moves, will satisfy this. It can be cooperative, it can be competitive. There are many different games, as Wittgenstein said. They don't all satisfy the same recipe. One thing that you have with the game analogy is the notion of score that changes straight away. So someone shoots a goal. The score changes straight away. Something also happens in the world, that the lights afterwards on the scoreboard are going to change. And the beliefs of everybody watching the goal being shot, the beliefs of everybody are going to change. They'll think, oh, wow, they've scored a goal, fantastic. Or they'll say, oh, how depressing, if it was the other team. So there will be the goal, which changes the score, and there will be other effects in the world. Which involve alterations maybe on the scoreboard, that physical entity, or maybe alterations in the attitudes of the hearers. That distinction between the immediate straightway alteration of score and the downstream changes of attitude, that's the distinction I want to have in mind in our ordinary language games which go on all around us. So, accommodation of score, now that I've explained what I mean by score, is this evolving normative structure, tracking changes straight away, and this, by the way, is often going to be at the level of what Austin called illocution, illocutionary speech acts. So straight away, the ship is named, when the speaker says, I hereby name the ship, the Queen Elizabeth. Straight away, the couple are married when they say, I do, in the right circumstances. The pattern for accommodation of score I've put on the handout under 2.1. Something is said at a given time. That requires something to be the case in the conversational score. It might be the permissibility of crossing the white line. So what might be said? The master says to the slave, you are now permitted to cross the white line. Straightway, the bounds of permissibility are altered, and the slave is permitted to cross the white line. Of course, afterwards the slave is going to believe he can cross the white line. That's a different stage. So, still accommodation of a score. Something is said, and it requires, in this case, that crossing the white line is permissible. Another example, this is again from Lewis's initial paper on this, even George could win. Even, that word even, adds to the conversational score, George is an unpromising candidate. Doesn't say that out loud, but it adds to the score, George is an unpromising candidate. That's the little goal that's shot in that conversation. And later on, downstream, Hearers are going to believe George is an unpromising candidate, but that's the later stage. I'm now just focusing on accommodation of score. So something is said, it requires something to be the case. If certain conditions hold, what Austin called the felicity conditions, then, for instance, suppose the master has authority over the slave, that will be a felicity condition. Suppose nobody blocks, suppose nobody says, what do you mean, even George? Nobody blocks, so there's an omission on the part of the hearers. By the way, later in time, I'm still talking about this being a felicity condition for something that happened earlier in time. I defended that odd metaphysical view in the first lecture, so I won't spend more time on it later. It's a bit, for those of you who know your moral philosophy, it's a bit like Williams on moral luck. The structure of something at time one depends on what's going to happen later as its felicity condition, if you like. Okay, so when all those conditions are in place, the magic happens and straightway what is required at the requirement stage gets delivered at that very time. That's the structure for accommodation of score. What about the attitudes? Those are going to be my topic today. The accommodation of common ground. These are the evolving shared attitudes of the participants. This is where we have, in the game analogy, the evolving attitudes of the onlookers of the game who think, oh gosh, a goal has just been scored, brilliant or terrible or whatever, and they might feel happy or they might feel unhappy. All of these effects happen later and they are not part of the score. They might be part of the common ground. Certainly the beliefs are. What else we can add to the common ground is something I'm going to talk about in just a minute. The accommodation of common ground tracks later changes at the level of what Austin called perlocution. Perlocution was Austin's label for the effects later in time of speech acts that had happened earlier in time. And they might be the practice of people starting to call the ship the Queen Elizabeth. They might be the disappointment of the mother-in-law that the marriage had taken place. This wouldn't be the point of it, but, you know, there might be all sorts of downstream perlocutionary effects, some of which are intended and some of which aren't. So, the pattern for accommodation of common ground, something is said at a given time. It requires something to be in the common ground at a later time. I'm now talking about this accommodation of attitude. At a later time. So, to take the master-slave example, when the master says, you are now permitted to cross the white line, that enacts a rule, that's what we had for the accommodation of score, it also requires that at a later time, the slave believes that the permissibility facts have changed and that he is now allowed to cross the white line. So the beliefs happen in response. To take the example, even George could win. What's required is that hearers take on board the presupposition George is an unpromising candidate, and they come to believe, in the straightforward case, they come to believe not only George could win, but also, because of that little word even, that George is an unpromising candidate. So the belief part, the shared beliefs that emerge in the context of a conversation, they are the evolving attitudes. They only come to be when certain conditions hold. So we have an analog for accommodation of common ground that is just like the pattern for score. You have something being said, you have a requirement, except it's a requirement that something happens a bit later, and it happens in the attitudes. You have certain conditions holding, which will be similar, and it's no coincidence that they're similar, because one of the conditions is going to be that a certain illocutionary act had just been made. So it's because the master said to the slave, you are now permitted to cross the white line, thereby enacting a permissibility fact that the slave comes to believe that the permissibility facts have changed. So the beliefs are responding, the beliefs, the changes in common ground, are responses to changes at the level of score. So when all that is in place, the outcome, which by the way, in the case of accommodation of common ground, the outcome is a causal outcome. That's why I'm not calling it a felicitous outcome, because I'm keeping the word felicity for the constitutive illocutionary case. It's a causal outcome. After T, after the time in question, what is required comes into being. The slave believes that the rules have changed and that he's now permitted to cross the white line. And the hearers in the conversation about George being an unpromising candidate, they come to believe, I've put acceptance here, they come to accept, which is not quite as strong as belief, that George is an unpromising candidate, as well as that George is going to even George could win. Okay, so what I've done just now is remind you of something that I said perhaps too fast in the first lecture about how we can understand the process of accommodation operating at two levels. One at the level of alterations of normative structure that affect what people are allowed to do later in the conversation. It becomes appropriate and permissible to do certain things and not to do certain things, just like in the case of a sports game. It becomes appropriate to do and not do certain things when someone's shot a goal. Likewise in a conversation. So it's this abstract alteration of structure. Then there are the alterations in the attitudes, the psychological states of the participants. I want to keep those distinct because I do not want to equate norms with attitudes, even though they are dependent, interdependent in various ways. So norms, an alteration in norms is not a matter of alteration in what people believe about the norms. Not straightforwardly, anyway. Okay, so we have two kinds of accommodation, and today what I especially want to talk about is accommodation of common ground, as I'm calling it here, because I'm especially interested in accommodating attitudes. You'll recall that mostly, up till now, I've been talking about the first sort of accommodation. I've been talking about the accommodation of score, understood as the way our speech becomes a speech act, thanks to the presence of background felicity conditions, some of which are contributed by background patterns of authority, some of which are contributed perhaps by speaker's intention, some of which are even contributed by hearers' recognition of what's going on, and even by hearers' omissions, doing nothing, not stepping in when a hate speaker is speaking on the train, abusing an Arab woman, to take the case I talked about in the first lecture. So, I've been focusing on alteration in score. I've been talking about accommodation at the level of score, at the level of what Austin called illocution. And today, I think I want to emphasize that this is going to have repercussions for what we believe, for what we desire, and for what we feel. So I'm not just leaving psychology out of it. It's not just all enactment of norms. It really makes a difference to us, to our minds, and that's why it makes a difference to our behavior. It's no coincidence that the slave then goes on to obey the rules enacted by the master, because the obedience is mediated by what's going on in the mind of the slave, as well as what's coming out of the mouth of the master. Just to remind you, I talked about accommodation of score as a way of unpacking the illocutionary act of authoritatively saying someone is inferior, understood as an illocutionary speech act. This is accommodation of score, the first sort. I talked about how it alters patterns of authority, formal and informal, epistemic and practical, as a felicity condition and also as an outcome. What you do with your words enacts authority structures, as well as being sensitive to background authority structures. I also talked about how what we do with our words can enact norms. Sometimes as the master enacts a norm to the slave, but sometimes much more subtly, as when, I argued, someone simply says, many people are stealing the petrified wood in our forest, please don't do it. That bit that says many people are stealing the petrified wood unwittingly enacts a norm of normalizing theft. So I talked about empirical studies which showed that where those signs were present, levels of theft went up. I was talking about how what we do with our words can enact norms by normalizing something, by making it seem ordinary, by making it seem legitimate because it's the ordinary done thing. And that's a kind of norm enactment that philosophers normally ignore. We normally look at orders. We normally look at the enactment of obligations when we make a promise. We don't look at something that looks just like a description of the world and is really a hidden prescription or a hidden permission. So those are the ones that I was interested in under the heading of norms. I looked at knowledge, how knowledge itself follows rules of accommodation, and I looked at how certain sorts of failures of accommodation, certain sorts of inability to do things with words, because the felicity conditions are not fulfilled, these constitute a certain kind of silence. That's by way of reminder of how we were using the notion of accommodation to unpack facts about how our words alter authority structures, alter norms, and alter patterns of knowledge as well. Now, in thinking about this second sort of accommodation that involves attitudes, I want to begin with a desideratum that was drawn up, maybe just in passing, by my friend and erstwhile colleague, Robert Stalnaker, who, in his famous paper on Common Ground, talked about how we need our philosophy of language to be sensitive to what people are doing with our words, what we are doing with our words. He says, the pragmatic notions developed to explain the linguistic phenomena, they need to be notions that help to connect the practice of speech with the purposes for which people engage in the practice. And then he goes on to say, the principal reason for speech is that people say things to get other people to come to know things they didn't know before. So Bob Stalnaker has a wonderfully rosy picture of the point of speech. It's about us getting each other to know things we didn't know before. And of course that is a hugely important function of speech. It is a hugely important purpose of speech, and it's certainly a hugely important sort of self-conception of speakers. But as you know, we've been looking at the dark side in these lectures so far, and we know that there are many, many other things that are done with words, that are done by hate speakers, that are done by pornographers, that are done by ordinary people in ordinary situations to enact norms that are not a matter of transmission of knowledge, but about changing normative structure. So, I want to add that the things that I've talked about, that the pragmatic notions that we are developing should be extended to enable us to do this sort of work, to help us see how the evolution of common ground can be understood as helping us see how norms get enacted, how knowledge evolves, and how authority structures change. But there's still something missing in this. And I've been following the part of Catherine MacKinnon where she says authoritatively saying someone is inferior is how structures of hierarchy are built, and how violence against those on the bottom is legitimated and normalized. That's a bit of a paraphrase, but that's something like what she said. That's what I've been looking at. But there's something missing in that. And I think the best way in is to tell you about an old study, which never fails to make me laugh, despite the fact that it's a rather depressing topic in other ways. In the course of the work that I have done in the past on pornography and whether it's a sort of speech act that might enact subordination, I looked at all sorts of empirical data, and this one really sticks in my mind. This is from a paper, it's a 1982 paper. It's number 7 on the handout. Experimenters created a mild boot fetish in heterosexual male students. So in this experiment, I'll just read it. In heterosexual male students, by pairing slides of sexually provocative women with a picture of a pair of black knee-length women's boots. So if you got it, what they did was show a slide of a sexually provocative woman, as described by the experimenter, and a slide of boots just by themselves, not on the woman, right? So woman. Boots, woman, boots, woman, boots, in the experimental setting. And they said, not only did the boots become somewhat sexually arousing, but there was a slight tendency for this conditioned response to generalize to other footwear as well. That's the bit that always makes me laugh, you know. Wow, I just can't take my eyes off those fluffy slippers. The generalization to other footwear as well. So the authors concluded that there is little question that sexual responsiveness can be conditioned to external stimuli that initially fail to elicit any sexual arousal. So this is obviously being written by a psychologist who is interested in whether or not pornography might be a form of conditioning, operant conditioning, I think. Okay, so... What that draws attention to is the very straightforward fact that's been missing out of all of the very rationalistic thing I've been saying so far, despite the fact I've been complaining about others being too rationalistic. What's missing? Well, what are we going to say about that particular case? Well, let's see. We have to think of the slides as a speech act. We have to say, okay, slide 1, provocative woman. Slide 2, boots. Woman, boots. Woman, boots. A conversation. We have to call this a conversation. woman, boots. Woman, boots. And we have to say, the hearer takes the speaker, whoever that is, to be saying boots are sexy. Or maybe presupposing, that boots are sexy. Otherwise, why on earth would they be associated in this way? Woman, boots, woman, boots. The presupposition, putting the boots in this sexually arousing context, is, wow, the boots are supposed to be sexy too. Right. So the hearer, doing the job of accommodating to what the speaker is trying to do, making best sense of what the speaker is trying to do, says, I see, so the boots are supposed to be sexy. Right, the boots are sexy. So I will take that on board. I won't block that presupposition because I have no reason not to. So just as the hearer takes on board, George is an unpromising candidate, so this hearer takes on board, oh, the boots are sexy. Right. Oh, therefore, I will find boots arousing. Really? So, they reach the conclusion, boots are sexy. That's how I make sense of this. And then they move to say, by some sort of internal syllogism, to the conclusion, therefore, I shall find boots arousing. And of course, being a psychology lab, they tested for all of the... They didn't just say, are boots arousing? They tested for arousal. And you can... I'm not even going to go there. I don't know how they went into that. So what's missing... Don't you think there's something a bit bizarre about this? I mean, don't you think this is a philosopher writing a story about how incredibly clever we are about... building our desires out of the evidence that's available to us. I see, someone is telling me that boots are sexy. Therefore, I will find boots sexy. Good. No. So the tempting thing to say is, okay, the psychologists have got it right, that this is a process of conditioning. So I don't know whether that's what we should say. There have been some philosophers who say, you know, there have been some philosophers who said we have to give up on this rationalistic picture of how conversations work when we see how, in fact, we respond to pictures and images, how advertisers feed us images that make us want stuff. It's not by some process of internal reasoning. It's not by some process of sort of making best sense of the speaker. It's not by some process of adjusting to what the speaker is trying to do with their words. It is just this mindless conditioning. And if you think that's so, then you have my sympathy, because I think there's a lot to be said for that view. Nevertheless, I am going to try and save some of these phenomena for philosophy, because I think they are philosophically interesting. And by the way, notice that if we are going to have a little turf war about this and say, okay, all of that stuff where it's not working like some kind of little internal syllogism or some kind of rational evolution of common ground, but it's in all those cases where it's not working like that, we'll leave to you psychologists, and you can tell us, oh, it's conditioning, and you'll tell me which of the many kinds of conditioning there is, or they might tell us it's something else. Anyway, can't philosophers find something intelligent to say about this phenomenon? I hope so. And so my goal in today's lecture is to think about whether the phenomenon of accommodation that we've been talking about, which is very well suited to the evolving shared attitudes of speakers who take on information, both explicit and implicit, from how hearers take on information from what speakers are doing, both implicitly and explicitly without words. It's so well suited to it that many linguists treat it simply as a process of information transmission. Can't we extend that to think about mental states other than belief or knowledge? And I think we can. So in thinking about how we might, I have to say I'm not the first to think about how we might extend the idea of common ground to include states that are not simply cognitive states. For instance, Michael Bratman, who works on intention, has work in his book that's just come out about how joint intentions, how group intentions, we intentions, emerge as the common ground of certain speech acts. Craigie Roberts talks about how speech acts set questions that are under discussion, and it's not a shared piece of information. It's a shared topic to be asked or topic to be considered. That's the question under discussion thought. Other linguists, Portner, talk about to-do lists, things that are to be done. It's very tempting in this area to think that one way to view the relation between the two sorts of accommodation I described is that what's done at the level of score has the following relationship to what's done at the level of common ground. It legitimates it, or it invites it. So, if I say even George could win, that legitimates the belief that George could win and the belief that George is an unpromising candidate. If I say, if I'm the master and I say to the slave, you are now permitted to cross the white line, that straightway alters the rule, but it also legitimates the belief that the rule has been altered, and it invites the belief. So I'm not sure whether to speak in terms of legitimation or invitation, but what I am interested in is that something is going on at the level of the normative structure, the score, that invites a certain response from the hearer. And this applies to all of those cognitive cases where belief emerges naturally in response to someone saying something, someone asserting something, someone telling you something, someone testifying something, whether implicitly or explicitly. Now, If we have that picture of certain speech acts as inviting a certain response, then we have a way of connecting the two sorts of accommodation. And we might have a way of connecting it with the sort of problematic speech that is my topic here. To remind you, the problematic speech that I've been attending to, by way of illustration and also because I think it is of tremendous importance and sometimes gets neglected, I've been looking at hate speech and at pornography. So just to remind you of some of the sorts of hate speech that I had in mind earlier, I mentioned the children's story, Der Giftpilz, the poison mushroom. This is number 4 on the list of quotations. A mother and son are in the woods mushroom hunting, and the caption says, and it's supposedly in the mouth of the mother, "Just as it's often hard to tell a toadstool from an edible mushroom, so too it is often very hard to recognize the Jew as a swindler and as a criminal." I talked about that as in terms of what it's doing to the credibility of Jewish people before, and I talked about it as in terms of what it's doing to the notion of the Jew as a generic, with all of the ambiguity and problems that come with generics that I talked about earlier. Here's another from the same book, The Experience of Hans and Elsa with a Strange Man. So I hope I made clear, this is a piece of anti-Semitic propaganda that was published by Julius Streicher. And this was published for a readership of children. The Experience of Hans and Elsa with a Strange Man. So there's an image of a hook-nosed, stereotypically Jewish-looking man in an overcoat offering sweets. And the caption says, "Here, little ones, I have some sweets for you, but you have to come along with me." So anyone who's seen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang will know it's just like the child catcher. So the image is like that one of the child catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So that is an example of hate speech which, okay, I'm now setting aside the epistemological injustice of that first story. Something is being said which requires something to be the case. So let's think about it in terms of the accommodation picture I've been describing. I'm now up to number 7 on the handout. The accommodation of score. Something is said at a particular time. This Jew is trying to kidnap these children. I say it's being said. There are two issues there in the background, which I've talked about earlier. It's not being asserted, it's being conveyed by the picture. And even though it's in the context of a fiction operator, there's something it's claiming about the real world. I'll get to that in a minute. So let's just suppose something's said, maybe it's being just said implicitly, this Jew is trying to kidnap these children. That requires something to be the case. It requires something to be in the score. So I'll do the accommodation of score first. The acceptability of the presuppositions, Jews kidnap children, it requires that Jews are, now here's what's tempting to say, Jews are to be hated. Jewish people are to be hated. This, I'm really interested in this gerundive way of putting it. Remember I said earlier that, you know, George is an unpromising candidate, is you're being invited to believe that by the presupposition. You can think of that as a gerundive structure. George is an unpromising candidate. This is to be believed. Yeah. So think of it as having this kind of gerundive structure. In this case, Jews are to be hated, as well as it's also the case that the proposition Jews kidnap children is to be believed. So there's a gerundive structure inviting the hearer, inviting a certain response to the hearer, believe this. And there's a gerundive part that is inviting the hearer to have not only a certain belief, but a certain feeling of hatred. So what got me thinking about this was, it was completely bizarre to suppose that we could say something intelligent about hate speech without talking about hate. I thought, this is just the worst sort of philosophically abstract enterprise if I'm supposed to be thinking about hate speech without thinking about hate. It's anyway, and I know that as philosophers we do speak too abstractly, but so I want to find out whether we can think about hate. And I think that the speaker is inviting that response. This, by the way, is implicit in the UN description of hate speech in the UN Convention Against Hate Speech, where they say in the 1965 declaration, state parties condemn all propaganda, this is quotation three, and organizations which are based on ideas or theories of superiority of one race or group of persons, etc., or which attempt to justify or promote racial hatred and discrimination in any form. The attempting to justify racial hatred, the attempting to promote racial hatred, I see that as a speech act that has a certain sort of invitation to the hearer. Now, this then, provided certain felicity conditions are in place, the speaker needs to have some epistemic authority. In this case, they had the rubber stamp of the Nazi Party. The hearers mustn't block. They mustn't say, hey, what do you mean by supposing that Jewish people are typically doing this? Or what do you mean by saying this thing in a fiction as if it's true of Jewish people in general, in the real world? So nobody blocks it. And then maybe, this is an interesting issue, maybe there needs to be a background sort of bridge principle, if you like, that says kidnappers in general are to be hated. So you have kidnappers in general are to be, there's a standing disposition to hate kidnappers, and then you find out Jewish people are kidnappers, and then that is a kind of internal syllogism which really would generate hate if you really did already hate kidnappers. So this gives us some sense of how the alteration at the level of score invites a certain response of hate, and then that is why the accommodation of the other sort, the accommodation of common ground, then makes sense in these terms. So let's move to the accommodation of common ground in response to this accommodation of score that I just described. So the thought is the accommodation of score is enacting norms, and the accommodation of common ground is responding to what has been enacted. The accommodation of a common ground in terms of the hearer's attitudes. So something is said, this Jew is trying to kidnap these children, we're talking about the same utterance. It requires that something is in the common ground afterwards, it's in the shared attitudes afterwards. For example, the shared belief that Jewish people kidnap children, that Jewish people are to be hated, and not just belief that they are to be hated, but actual hatred, possibly mediated by this background bridging principle of hate, if you like, that I was calling it. What I just said about hate, by the way, can be extended to fear and desire and other attitudes too, but let's just stick to hate. So this is only when certain conditions hold, and in particular that this has just been said and that this score has just changed in the way I just described when I was describing score accommodation. Now there is a causal outcome. The causal outcome is that what is required by this process of accommodation actually causally comes into being at this later time. The shared belief that Jewish people kidnap children, that they are to be hated, and shared hatred of Jews. So the picture is, so to speak, speaker invites hearer into a shared belief world. Speaker invites hearer into a shared hate world as well. Hearer responds. Depending on the circumstances, the felicity conditions in play, hearer responds and joins that belief world. That's what philosophers of language are always talking about. And also joins the hate world. So what I'm arguing is that we ought to extend what can be included in common ground to include feelings like hatred, as well as cognitive states like belief and knowledge, and those sorts of things that philosophers are so keen on. Okay, so that was hatred. Now I'll do it for desire, which was my starting example. Instead of talking about the boots and the lady, I'm going to shift to the sort of pornography which Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin have talked about, and in particular the sort that I've talked about earlier in these lectures where certain rape myths are in play. So I don't know if I want to read it out, given that this is being recorded. It's number 8 on your handout. It's a story from Hustler that is called Dirty Pool. And in this series of images, which are captioned, there are a sequence of events where a woman, after a certain series of events, during which she says no and resists resists what a group of men are doing, she succumbs to their advances and they have sex with her on the pool table. And the most salient thing is that she is represented as having said no repeatedly and then as absolutely loving what happens at the end. She's completely ecstatic, that's to put it mildly. Anyway, so for details that I don't feel like reading out, you can just see the description that's under 8 on your handout, and it's described in a book by Catherine Itzen, which is also in the readings. Okay, so what's salient for our purposes about this is that so we have accommodation of score, and we're going to have accommodation of common ground, both sorts. Something is said in this extended speech act, this series of images in Hustler. This woman says no but doesn't mean it. Now, I'm saying it's said, I'm interpreting said rather loosely. It can be, maybe it's not said explicitly. Maybe it's just there in the background of the fiction. This woman in the fiction is saying no, and she doesn't mean no. And in fact, she is loving every minute of it, and she ends up in ecstasy. It's what the social scientists who study this describe as a favorable rape depiction. A favorable rape depiction is one where the rape is depicted as favorable because the woman ends up wanting it. So something is said, it requires something to be in the score at a given time, the acceptability of certain presuppositions. It's not just this woman, but women generally, I would argue. Women who say no don't mean it. Moreover, it's not just a cognitive presupposition. It's not just women who say, let me tell you an interesting fact about women. Women who say no don't mean it. It's not just that. It's being presented a certain way. It's being presented a certain way, many feminists who've talked about pornography have talked about this in ways that philosophers have found hard to take up, because we have to see it as an issue of information transmission. So, for instance, Catherine MacKinnon says, pornography, this is quotation 9, sexualizes rape, battery, sexual harassment, and child sexual abuse. It celebrates, promotes, authorizes, and legitimates them. This is in keeping with the quotation that I had earlier about how certain speech acts authoritatively say someone is inferior, but it's making especially the connection with the idea of sexualizing. Now, I don't know whether to sexualize something is a kind of illocutionary speech act. That would, even to utter the thought is to make poor J.L. Austin roll in his grave. But what does seem like an illocutionary speech act is the idea that certain behaviors are being celebrated, are being endorsed, and if I knew more about this part of philosophy of language, I would say it's something about the mode of presentation of, it's not just, you know, a little item in a medical textbook, did you know that sometimes women who say no don't mean it? No, it's being presented as really exciting and arousing in the way that advertising sells certain things. So it's that selling component, that celebrating, promoting, to use the words of the UN Convention, that is being missing that we're missing out on if we simply say it's presupposing this rape myth as a certain factual background. I think it is doing that, but it's doing more. It's not just doing an endorsement, it's doing a sexualizing, which involves an invitation not only to belief, in the truth of the rape myth, but in a certain alteration in desire. So it's directed to belief and to desire, in the way, as we all know, advertising is, right? So it's directed to our attitudes, not just our cognitive attitudes, but our conative attitudes. And I don't know enough about how images work to know how that works, but that doesn't stop me knowing it does work. Okay, so we have, this is to be desired, we have an illocutionary force of sexualizing, I did put it with a question mark because I'm not sure that's an illocutionary act, celebrating, inviting a certain desire. Certain conditions need to hold, there needs to be epistemic authority, this needs to be credible, maybe. Maybe something, maybe it doesn't, that's an interesting question whether it needs that actually. If it's just appealing to desire, maybe it doesn't. I'll shelve that for now. The outcome, straightway what is required comes into being. And this sort, this, and the state of affairs in which women who say no don't mean it, is not just something that comes to be believed in, it's something that comes to be seen as desirable and as arousing. That's the part that I am trying to emphasize. So I'm trying to do for the desire case what I was trying to do for the hate case. Now, that's the accommodation at the level of score. Norms are altered at the level of the speech act itself. So I'm trying to get away from just the issue, just the conditioning way of putting it. Now, because this response is invited, the response actually comes into being. So accommodation of common ground responds to the accommodation of score in just the same way as the case of hate. Something is said, this woman says no but doesn't mean it. Something's required to be in the common ground, the shared belief that women who say no don't mean it, and also that this is a really exciting, heady, arousing idea. So the arousing desirability of it is something else that comes into being as well as the belief. That's what's required to come into being. And provided certain conditions hold, that is, and this is the causal outcome, that is what indeed does come into being. So I hope you see how we have these comparable patterns for accommodation of score and of accommodation of common ground, but what we're doing is extending common ground to include the attitudes not just of belief or knowledge, but also the attitudes of hate for hate speech and of desire for pornography. There will also, by the way, be much wider implications, and I don't have time to go into them, but I'm now just going to mention 4 points by way of unfinished business, because you will be able to tell that this is really very much work in progress. Anyway, and I welcome your thoughts. The first bit of unfinished business is we need to think harder about the interaction among these different attitudes. I said that there's this kind of gerundive structure in the score. Something is to be believed, and something is to be hated, and something is to be desired. What are the connections between those attitudes? So, for instance, the connections between something is to be believed and something is to be hated. It's to be believed that Jews are kidnappers and Jews are to be hated. Those could be connected by means of the bridging principle I said, but maybe they don't need to be. Maybe there could be hate speech that didn't work by way of some background principle that you do hate kidnappers. As we talked about earlier, certain forms of words are virulently hateful without appealing to any background principle. The Rwandan hate speech that I've mentioned before, where the Tutsi were described as inyenzi or cockroaches, using animal-like vocabulary to make people seem disgusting and animal-like. This doesn't work by some background. This doesn't work by way of the same background principles. Words can be used to whip up hate in ways that are more direct. That's my thought. It doesn't have to be mediated by some background principle. So that's for hate. What about desire? Suppose people come to desire that women suppose some people come to believe that women who say no don't mean it, and they come to find that state of affairs a desirable or arousing one. Which comes first? Is it the desire? Is it the belief? Is it both together? Is it, if it's the desire first, wow, this is so sexy, then the belief is coming on board as a kind of mechanism of cognitive dissonance resolution, where it's a kind of wishful thinking. The belief is being generated by the sort of desire part of it. Or is it the other way around? So this is, I'm mentioning this as unfinished business. I think it's really interesting to think about how our thinking works in these cases. I mentioned already that there are clear connections to the locutionary resources we have. Remember, for Austin, locution is the part about words and sentences, how words refer, how sentences have meaning and truth values. The availability of certain words, like in Yenze for cockroach, like the Jew, who's been essentialized as a kind of slur term in the hate speech. We talked about gender slurs, slut, frigid, in previous lectures. And of course, there are much, much worse slurs and epithets available than those. The availability of resources in the locution is going to affect what illocutionary things you can do with your words, and that will adjust the score, and then affect the attitudes as well. So the availability, I'm saying something obvious, the availability of hateful words, including epithets, is part of what helps promote and cause hatred. So we need to understand those connections. And it's important to think about them, by the way, because philosophers often tend to think just of the speaker. So the work on slurs is about the semantics of slurs. It's about what speakers need to believe about the world, and it's about what emotions speakers want to express. They might want to express their feelings. It's not just about that. It's about what people are doing with words to other people. It's what people are doing with words to other people, where that involves enacting norms and authority structures that rank them as inferior, deprive them of powers and rights, and actually assault them. That's, hate speech can be assaultive. So there are much bigger issues at play than the speaker-oriented ones that philosophers focusing on epithets tend at present to focus on. So that's the relation to locutionary resources. Extension to other attitudes. I mentioned this already implicitly with the example of animal epithets. The availability of certain locutions makes us realize that certain words are especially good, not just at helping us think certain people are inferior. So this is a kind of mea culpa. I've been complaining about philosophers being too abstract, and I've been way too abstract so far, because I've been talking, admittedly, I've been talking more than how information gets transmitted through conversations. I've been talking about the enactment of norms and authority structures, but I haven't been talking about the hatred, I haven't been talking about the desire, and if we were going to be very thorough, we would think about other attitudes too. Jonathan Haidt has talked about how impoverished our moral vocabulary is when we think merely in terms of inequality, and hierarchy, forgetting that part of our moral stance towards the world involves disgust. It involves thinking certain people are not just inferior, they are disgusting. And the availability of certain words and certain images enables people to do that with their words in ways that wouldn't happen if that wasn't available. This is something that the epithets literature also really needs to take seriously. The different attitudes, the different morally loaded attitudes that we have. It's so much richer. And, you know, this is an Austinian point. Austin was interested in the richness and variety of things we do with our words. And I'm sorry I'm looking at the dark side, but there's a richness and a variety of the terrible things we do with our words as well. The last thing I want to say is that the accommodation of desire brings with it a different topic. You'll remember that I talked about how what we do with our words can legitimate certain things by normalizing it. So the speech act that says, an awful lot of people are stealing, please don't, is a speech act that normalizes stealing and makes it more permissible than it otherwise would be. So that was under the heading of normalizing. Legitimation is normalizing. Now, speech acts that make certain things desirable by making them desired. Now, of course, being desired is not the same as being desirable. People always, you know, throw stones at poor J.S. Mill for conflating desirability and desiredness. Nevertheless, epistemologically, what I'm interested in is how seeing the world through the guise of certain desires is an epistemological resource. One of our ways of finding out what matters is through desire. Desire is a way of telling what matters. So this belongs to much wider, much bigger topics in moral epistemology. I do not see desire as this little spring to action that just sort of works on it, you know, like it. Anyway, I'm not going to say all the reasons I don't like the Humean picture of beliefs and desires. Desire, looking at the world through the eyes of desire, is a way of reading values off the world. I'm not the only one who takes seriously this thought. But of course, if that's so, then reading the world through the eyes of desires that are shaped by oppressive structures, that are shaped by disgust for the animal-like nature of certain people, or shaped by a mixture of disgust and desire for the actually animal-like nature of women as well, as it can apply this issue to the case of racial hatred and to the case of the oppressive desires in pornography. What I want to say is this is an unnoticed aspect to norms. When we find things desirable, that gives them a normative standing that they otherwise wouldn't have because of facts about the epistemology of desire. That is a huge topic, that's why I listed it under unfinished business. And there's one more thing I should have listed under unfinished business. Once you see that hate speech works like this, once you see that pornography works like this, once you see that there is accommodation of attitudes other than belief, then you will see that it is hard to answer bad speech with good speech. Because when someone has a false belief and you spell it out, even if it's just presupposed and you make them spell it out, then you can say, well, why do you believe that? Tell me your reasons. But when someone has a very strong emotion, hatred, or when someone has a very strong conative state, a desire or a pattern of arousal, you can't just say, tell me your reasons for that. Let me give you some evidence against that. It's not the same thing. It's not as easy. So what we have is yet one more reason to question Brandeis's sanguine assumption that bad speech can always be fought with good. Thank you. That's enough for today, and I'll stop there.